Shower? Disinfect. Oh, you haven't been here. A White House staff member is sick with this virus thing. Everybody has to shower and disinfect on the way in now. Come on, O'Day said, carrying a briefcase. Both men went through the west entrance. Both buzzed the metal detectors, but since both were sworn federal officers, nothing was made of the fact that both were carrying sidearms. The inspector pointed to the left.
This is a treat, showing you something in the place, he joked to Raymond.
Been in a lot lately? The Secret Service agent saw that two offices had been converted into something, one marked men and the other women. Andrea Price came out of one just then, her hair wet, and he noted as she passed him smelling of chemicals. "Hey, Jeff, how was the drive? Pat, how's the hero?" she inquired.
"Hey, no big deal, Price, just two ragheads," O'Day said with a grin.
He opened the men door and went in and set his briefcase down. It had clearly been a rush job, Raymond saw. Some minor functionary had had the office, but all the furniture was gone and the floor covered with plastic. A hanging rack was there for clothing. O'Day stripped down and headed into the canvas-enclosed shower.
"These damn chemicals at least wake you up," the FBI inspector reported as the water started.
He emerged 2 minutes later and started toweling off vigorously. "Your turn, Raymond."
"Great," the service agent griped, removing his clothing and showing some of the lingering body modesty of his parent society.
O'Day didn't look at him and didn't look away, didn't do anything except dry off, until Raymond was behind the canvas. The agent's service pistol, a Sig Sauer, had been set atop the clothing rack. O'Day opened his briefcase first. Then he pulled Raymond's automatic, ejected the magazine, and quietly worked the action to remove the chambered round.
"How are the roads?" O'Day called.
"Clear. Made great time."
"Damn, this water stinks."
"Ain't that the truth?"
Raymond kept two spare magazines for his pistol, O'Day saw. He put all three in the lid pocket before unwrapping the four he'd prepared. One he slid into the butt of the Sig. He worked the action one more time to load around, then replaced it with a new full magazine, and two more for the agent's belt holder. Finished, he hefted the gun. Weight and balance were exactly the same as before. Everything went back in place as O'Day returned to dressing. He needn't have rushed. Raymond evidently needed a shower. Maybe he was purifying himself, the inspector thought coldly.
"Here." O'Day tossed over a towel as he put his shirt on.
"Glad I brought a change." Raymond pulled new underwear and socks from his two-suiter.
"I guess it's a rule you have to be all spiffy when you work in with the president, eh?"
The FBI agent bent down to tie his shoes. He looked up.
"Morning, Director."
"I don't know why I bothered at home," Murray grumped.
"Got the paperwork, Pat?"
"Yes, sir. This is something to show him."
"Damn right it is."
And Murray doffed his jacket and tie. "White House locker room," he noted. "Morning, Raymond." Both agents completed dressing, made sure their personal weapons were tucked in the right place, then stepped outside.
"Murray and I are going right in," Pat told the other in the corridor.
They didn't have to wait long for Murray, and then Price showed up again, just as the FBI director reemerged. O'Day rubbed his nose to tell her all was done. She nodded back.
"Jeff, want to take these gentlemen into the office? I have to head to the command post. The boss is waiting."
"Sure, Andrea. This way," Raymond said, leading O'Day. Behind them, Price waited and did not head toward the command post. In the next level up, Raymond saw TV equipment being prepared for installation in the Oval Office. Arnie Van Dam buzzed out the corridor entrance, trailed by Callie Weston. President Ryan was at his desk in the usual shirt sleeves going through a folder. CIA Director Ed Foley was in there, too.
"Enjoy the shower, Dan?" the DCI asked.
"Oh, yeah. I'm losing the rest of my hair, Ed."
"Hi, Jeff," the president said, looking up.
"Good morning, Mr. President," Raymond said, taking his usual place against the wall. "Okay, Dan, what do you guys have for me?" Ryan asked. "We've broken an Iranian espionage ring. We think it's associated with the attempt on your daughter." While Murray talked, O'Day opened his briefcase and pulled out a folder. "The Brits turned the connection," Foley started to say. "And the contact here is a guy named Alahad. Would you believe the bastard has a business about a mile from here?" "We have him under surveillance right now," Murray put in. "We're running his phone records." They were all looking down at the papers on the president's desk and didn't see Raymond's face freeze in place. His mind started racing, as though a drug had been injected into his bloodstream. If they were doing that right now, there might still be a chance, a slim one. But if not, here was the president, the directors of FBI and CIA, and he could deliver them all to Allah. And if that weren't sacrifice enough... Raymond unbuttoned his jacket with his left hand. He eased off the spot on the wall he was leaning against and closed his eyes for a quick prayer. Then, in a rapid, smooth movement, his right hand went to his automatic. Raymond was surprised to see the president's eyes move and stare right at him. Well, that wasn't so bad, was it? Ryan should know that his death was coming, and the only shame was he'd never quite understand why. Ryan flinched as the pistol came out. The reaction was automatic, despite the briefing on what to expect, and the sign from O'Day that it was okay. He dodged anyway, wondering if he could really trust anyone, and saw that Jeff Raymond's hands tracked him and pulled back on the trigger like an automaton. No emotion in his eyes at all. The sound made everyone jump, albeit for different reasons. Pop. That was all. Raymond's mouth dropped open in disbelief. The weapon was loaded. He could feel the added weight of the live rounds in it and... "Put it down," O'Day said calmly, his Smith out and aimed now. An instant later, Murray had his service weapon out. "We have Alahad in custody already," the director explained. Raymond had another weapon, a telescoping billy club called an ASP, but the president was 15 feet away and... "I can put one right through your kneecap if you want," O'Day said coldly. "You fucking traitor," Andrea said, entering the room with her pistol out too. "You fucking assassin! On the floor, now!" "Easy, Price. He's not going anywhere," Pat told her. But it was Ryan who nearly lost control. "My little girl. My baby. You helped plan to murder her?" He started around the desk, but Foley stopped him. "No, not this time, Ed." "Stop," the DCI told him. "We have him, Jack. We've got him." "One way or another, you get on the floor," Pat said, ignoring the others and aiming at Raymond's knee. "Drop the weapon and get down." He was trembling now. Fear, rage, all manner of emotions assaulted him, everything but the one he'd expected. He racked the SIG's action and pulled the trigger again. It wasn't even aimed. It was just an act of denial. "I couldn't use blanks. They don't weigh the same," O'Day explained. "They're real rounds. I just tap the bullets out and dump the powder. The primer makes a cute little pop, doesn't it?" It was as though he'd forgotten to breathe for a minute or so. Raymond's body collapsed in on itself. He dropped the pistol to the rug with the seal of the president on it and fell to his knees. Price came over and pushed him the rest of the way. Murray, for the first time in years, snapped the cuffs on. "You want to hear about your rights?" the FBI director asked. Chapter 59 Rules of Engagement. Diggs had not received proper mission orders yet, and what was even more disturbing, his Operation Buford did not really have much of a plan yet either. The Army trained its commanders to act swiftly and decisively, but, as with doctors in hospitals, emergency situations were not as welcome as planned procedures. The general was in continuous contact with the commanders of his two cavalry regiments, the senior Air Force commander, the One Star who'd brought the 366th over, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, and various intelligence assets, just trying to get a feel for what the enemy was actually doing, and from that to determine what the enemy might be planning, from which he would try to formulate some sort of plan on his own, aside from mere ad hoc reaction. The orders and rules of engagement arrived on his fax machine around 1100 Washington time, 1600 Zulu time, and 1900 Lima or local time. Here was the explanation he'd lacked. He relayed it at once to his principal subordinates and assembled his staff to brief them. The troops, he told the assembled officers, would learn from their commander-in-chief. Their officers would have to be with their people when that word came down. Things were busy enough. According to the satellites, the Army of God, as the intelligence people had determined the name to be, was within 100 miles of the Kuwaiti border, approaching from the west in good order and following the roads as expected. That made the Saudi deployment look pretty good, since three of their five brigades were covering the approaches to the oil fields. They still weren't ready. The 366th Wing was in the kingdom, but it wasn't enough to have the airplanes on the right airfields. 1,000 minor details had to be sorted out, and that job wasn't even half done yet. The F-16s from Israel were pretty well spun up, all 48 of their single-engine fighters running, and even some kills recorded in the initial skirmishes. But the rest needed another day. Similarly, the 10th Cav was fully ready, but the 11th was not. It was still assembling and moving to its initial deployment area. His 3rd Brigade had just started drawing equipment. An army wasn't a collection of weapons. It was a team composed of people with an idea of what they were supposed to be doing. But picking the time and place for war was usually the job of an aggressor, which was a role his country hadn't practiced very much. He looked at the 3-page fax again. It seemed quite literally explosive in his hands. His planning staff read their copies and were eerily quiet until the 11th's S3, the regimental operations officer, said it for all of them. "We're gonna get some." 3 Russians had recently arrived. Clark and Chavez had to remind themselves that this wasn't some sort of alcohol-induced dream. The 2 CIA officers were being supported by Russians under mission orders from Langley by way of Moscow. Actually, they had 2 missions. The Russians had drawn the hard one, and had brought the necessary equipment in the diplomatic pouch for the 2 Americans to have a try at the easier one. A dispatch had also come from Washington via Moscow that all of them read. "Too fast, John," Ding breathed. Then his mission face came on. "But what the hell?" The press room was still underpopulated. So many of the regulars were elsewhere, some caught out of town and blocked by the travel ban, others just missing, and nobody quite sure why. "The president will be making a major speech in 1 hour," Van Damme told them. "Unfortunately, there will be no time to give you advance copies of the speech. Please inform your networks that this is a matter of the highest importance." "Arnie," a reporter called, but the chief of staff had already turned his back. The reporters in Saudi knew more than both their friends back in Washington, and they were moving out to join their assigned units. For Tom Donner, it was B Troop, 1st of the 11th. He was fully outfitted in a desert battle dress uniform, or BDU, and found the 29-year-old troop commander standing by his tank. "Howdy," the captain said, halfway looking up from his map. "Where do you want me?" Donner asked. The captain laughed. "Never ask a soldier where he wants a reporter, sir." "With you, then?" "I ride this," the officer responded, nodding at the tank. "I'll put you in one of the brads." "I need a camera crew." "They're already here," the captain told him, pointing. "Over that way." "Anything else?" "Yeah, would you like to know what this is all about?" Donner asked. The journalists had been virtual prisoners in a Riyadh hotel, not even allowed to call home to tell their families where they were. All they'd known was that the reporters had been called up, and their parent corporations had signed agreements not to reveal the purpose of their absences for such deployments. In Donner's case, the network said that he was on assignment, a difficult thing to explain with the travel ban. But they had been told the overall situation. There'd been no avoiding it, which put them one up on a lot of soldiers. "We hear that in an hour or so, or that's what the colonel told us." But the young officer was interested now. "This is something you need to know now. Honest. Mr. Donner, I know what you pulled on the president, and if you want to shoot me, do it later. Listen to me, Captain. This is important." "Say your say, sir." There seemed something perverse in being made up at a time like this. It was, as always, Mary Abbott doing the job, wearing her mask, and this time gloves as well, while both teleprompters ran their copy. Ryan hadn't had the time or really the inclination to rehearse. Important as the speech was, he only wished to do it once. "They can't do cross-country," the Saudi general insisted. "They haven't trained for it, and they're still roadbound." "There is information to suggest otherwise, sir," Diggs said. "We are ready for them." "You're never ready enough, General. Nobody is." It was tense, but otherwise normal at Palm Bowl. Downloaded satellite photos told them that the UIR forces were still moving, and if they continued, then they would be met by two Kuwaiti brigades fighting on their own turf, and an American regiment in reserve, and the Saudis ready to provide rapid support. They didn't know how the battle would turn out. The overall numbers weren't favorable. But it wouldn't be like the last time, Major Sabah told himself. It seemed so foolish to him that the Allied forces could not strike first. They knew what was coming. "Getting some radio chatter," a technician reported. Outside, the sun was just starting to set. The satellite photos the intelligence officers looked at were 4 hours old. More would not be available for another two. Stormtrack was close to the Saudi UIR border, too far for a mortar round, but not safe from real tube artillery. A company of 14 Saudi tanks was now arrayed between the listening post and the berm. There also, for the first time in days, they were starting to copy radio transmissions. The signals were scrambled, more like the command sets than the regular tactical radios, which were far too numerous for easy encryption systems. Unable to read them immediately, that was the job of the computers back at KKMC, they did start trying to locate their points of origin. In 20 minutes, they had 30 point sources. 20 represented brigade headquarters, 6 for the division command posts, 3 for the corps commanders, and 1 for the army command. They seemed to be testing their commonet, the Elint people decided. They'd have to wait for the computers to unscramble what was being said. The direction finders had them arrayed on the road to Al Bisaya, still doing their approach march to Kuwait. The radio traffic wasn't all that remarkable. Maybe, most thought, the Army of God needed more practice in march discipline, though they hadn't done all that badly in their exercise. With sunset, the Predators were launched again, motoring north. They headed to the radio sources first of all. Their cameras turned on 10 miles inside the UIR, and the first thing one of them saw was a battery of 203-millimeter towed guns off their trucks, their limbers spread out, and the tubes pointed south. "Colonel," a sergeant called urgently. Outside, the Saudi tankers had selected hillocks to hide behind and were putting a few crewmen out to act as spotters. The first few had just started to settle into their observation points when the northern horizon flashed orange. Diggs was still discussing deployment patterns when the first message came in. "Sir, Stormtrack reports they're taking artillery fire." "Good morning, my fellow Americans," Ryan said to the cameras. His image was being carried worldwide. His voice would be heard even by those without TV sets at hand. In Saudi Arabia, his words went out on AM, FM, and shortwave bands, so that every soldier, sailor, and airman would hear what he was about to say. "We have been through much in the past 2 weeks. The first order of business is to tell you of progress we have made with the epidemic which has been inflicted upon our country. It was not easy for me to order the imposition of a ban on interstate travel. There are few freedoms more precious than the right to come and go as one pleases. But based on the best medical advice, I felt it necessary to take that action. I can report to you now that it has had the desired effect. New disease cases have been trending down for 4 days now. Partly that's because of what your government did, but it's more because you have taken the proper measures to protect yourselves. We will give more detailed information later in the day. But for the moment, I can tell you that the Ebola epidemic is going to end, probably in the next week. Many of the new cases are people who will definitely survive. America's medical professionals have performed superhuman work to help the afflicted, and to help us understand what has happened and how best to combat it. This task is not yet complete, but our country will weather this storm, as we have weathered many others. A moment ago, I said that the epidemic has been inflicted upon us. The arrival of this disease into our country was not an accident. We have been struck with a new and barbaric form of attack. It's called biological warfare. That is something outlawed by international treaty. Biological warfare is designed to terrify and to cripple a nation rather than to kill it. We've all felt the disgust and horror at what's been happening in our country, the way in which the disease attacks people at random. My own wife, Kathy, has worked around the clock with Ebola victims at her hospital in Baltimore. As you know, I was only there a few days ago to see for myself. I saw the victims, talked with the doctors and nurses, and outside the hospital, I sat with a man whose wife was ill. I could not tell him then, but I can tell you now, that from the beginning we suspected that this epidemic was a man-made act. And over the last few days, our law enforcement and intelligence agencies have formulated the proof we needed before I could tell you what you are about to hear. On TV screens across the world appeared the faces of a young African boy and a white-clad Belgian nun. This disease started some months ago in the country of Zaire, the president went on. He had to walk everyone through it, slowly and carefully, and Ryan found it hard to keep his voice even. The Saudi tankers remounted their vehicles at once, fired up the turbine engines, and moved to new locations lest their original points had been spotted. But the fire they saw was aimed at storm track. That made sense, their commander thought. The listening post was a prime intelligence gathering point. Their job was to protect it, which they could do against tanks and troops, but not against artillery fire. The Saudi captain was a handsome, almost rakish young man of 25. He was also devoutly religious, and therefore mindful of the fact that the Americans were guests of his country, and thus worthy of his protection. He got on his radio to call back to his battalion headquarters and requested armored personnel carriers, helicopters would have been suicidal, to evacuate the intelligence specialists. And so we have the disease traveling from Africa to Iran. How do we know this? The president asked. We know it because the disease traveled back to Africa on this aircraft. Please note the registration code, HXNJA. This is the same aircraft supposedly lost with Sister Jean-Baptiste aboard. We need another day, damn it, Diggs thought, and the enemy forces were nearly 200 miles west of where everyone planned to meet them. Who's closest, he asked. 4th Brigade's area, the senior Saudi replied. But that brigade was spread over a front of over 100 miles. There were some helicopter reconnaissance assets there, but the attack choppers were also in the wrong place, 50 miles south of Wadi el-Batin.
The other side wasn't cooperating very well, was it?
Daryai was shocked to see his photograph on TV. Worse, at least 10% of the people in his country were seeing this. The American CNN was not available in the UIR, but the British Sky News service was, and nobody had thought to. "This is the man behind the biological attack upon our country," Ryan said, with the sort of calm that seemed robotic. "He is the reason several thousand of our citizens have died. Now I will tell you why he did this, why there was an attack on my daughter, Katie, and why there was an attempt on my own life right in the Oval Office a few hours ago. I imagine Mr. Daryai is watching this broadcast, too, right now. Mahmoud Haji," he said right into the camera's eye, "your man, Arif Rehman, is now in federal custody. Do you really think America is as foolish as that?" Like everyone else in the Black Horse, Tom Donner was listening, in his case, with a pair of headphones off the Bradley's radio. There weren't quite enough to go around, and the crewmen had to share. He watched their faces. They, too, were as blank and expressionless as Ryan's voice had been, until his last sentence of contempt. "Fuck," one Spec 4 said. He was an 11 Delta, a cavalry scout, and backup gunner for this track. "My God," Donner managed to say. Ryan went on. "UIR forces are now poised to invade our ally, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Over the past 2 days, we have moved forces there to stand with our friends. There is something very important I must say now. The attack on my daughter, the attempt on my own life, and the barbaric attack on our country was undertaken by people who call themselves Muslims. We must all understand that religion has nothing at all to do with these inhuman acts. Islam is a religion. America is a country in which religious liberty is the first freedom expressed in our Bill of Rights, even before speech and all the others. Islam is not the enemy of our country or any other. Just as my family was once attacked by people calling themselves Catholics, so these people have twisted and defiled their own religious faith in the name of worldly power, and then hidden behind it like the cowards they are. What God thinks of that, I cannot say. I know that Islam, like Christianity and Judaism, teaches us about a God of love and mercy and justice. Well, there will be justice. If the UIR forces arrayed on the Saudi border move to invade, we will meet them. Our armed forces are in the field even as I speak to you, and now I will speak directly to them. Now you know why you have been taken away from your homes and families. Now you know why you must take up arms in the defense of your country. Now you know the nature of your enemy and the nature of his acts. But America does not have a tradition of deliberate attack on the innocent. You will act in accordance with our laws at all times. I must now send you into battle. I wish this were not necessary. I have myself served as a Marine, and I know what it is like to be in a foreign place. But you stand there for your country, and here at home your country stands up for you. You will be in our prayers. To our allies in Kuwait, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Oman, and all the Gulf states, America stands again with you to stop aggression and restore the peace. Good luck. Ryan's voice changed then, for the first time allowing his emotions to show. And good hunting. The crewmen in B Troop's command track looked at one another for several seconds before anyone spoke. They even managed to forget the presence of the reporter. The youngest of them, a PFC, looked down at shaking hands and had his say. "Fucker's gonna pay. Motherfucker's gonna pay for this, guys." 4 armored personnel carriers were racing across the desert at about 40 miles per hour,
They avoided the beaten dirt road to Storm Track for fear that it would be targeted with artillery fire. That proved to be a sensible precaution. Their first view of their objective was a cloud of smoke and dust drifting away from the antenna farm as fire continued to pour into the site. One of the three buildings appeared to be standing but on fire, and the Saudi lieutenant leading the scout platoon wondered if anyone could possibly be alive there. To the north he saw a different sort of flash. 5 miles away, the horizontal tongue of flame from a tank's main gun illuminated the bumps and knolls of a landscape that was not at all as level as it appeared in daylight. A minute after that, the fire on Storm Track diminished somewhat, shifting to where the tanks were evidently engaging enemy vehicles invading his country. He thanked Allah that his immediate job had just gotten a little easier while his radio operator called ahead on the track's tactical radio. The four APCs picked their way through the fallen antennas on the way into the wrecked compound. Then their rear doors opened and the soldier raced out to look around. 30 men and women worked here. They found 9 unhurt people plus 5 wounded. The scout platoon took about 5 minutes searching the wreckage, but no more living people were discovered, and there wasn't time to be fastidious about the dead. The tracks moved out, back toward the battalion CP, where helicopters waited to ferry the Americans out. It amazed the Saudi tank commander that surprise had been achieved. He knew that most of his country's forces were 200 miles to the east, but the enemy was here and coming south. They weren't going into Kuwait, or after the oil fields at all. That became plain when the first UIR tanks appeared in his thermal viewer, cresting a low spot in the berm, out of gun range because he'd been ordered not to move too close. The young officer really didn't know what to do. Ordinarily, his military worked under fairly tight control, and so he radioed back for instructions. But his battalion commander was busy now, his own command of 54 tanks and other vehicles spread over a front of 30 kilometers, all of which was being hit with indirect artillery fire, and much of which was reporting enemy tanks crossing the border with infantry carriers in support. Decided he had to do something, so he ordered his tanks forward to meet the attack. At 3,000 meters his men opened fire, and the first 14 shots resulted in 8 hits. Not bad under the circumstances for part-time soldiers, he thought as he decided to stand and fight right there, and defend his soil against the invader. His 14 tanks were spread over a line 3 kilometers long. It was a defensible deployment, but a stationary one, and in the center of his own line he was too fixed on what lay before him. The second volley got another 6 kills at the long range, but then one of his tanks took a direct hit from an artillery round, which destroyed its engine and started a fire that made its crew bail out, only to be shredded by more of the artillery fire before they could run 5 meters. He was looking that way and saw them die 400 meters away, and he knew that there was a hole in his line now, and he was supposed to do something about that. His gunner, like the others, was looking for and trying to engage enemy tanks, the T-80s with their domed turrets, when the first flight of anti-tank missiles zoomed away from the BMP infantry carriers that lay behind them. Those started getting hits, and though they could not penetrate the frontal armor on his tanks, tracks were knocked off, more engines set afire, and fire control systems damaged. When half his command was burning, it was time to pull back. 4 started moving again, turning and darting 2 kilometers south. The captain remained with the other 3, and got another tank kill before he started to move. The air was filled with missiles now, and one of them hit the rear of his turret, igniting the ammo storage box. The vertical flame sucked the air from the open hatch, asphyxiating his crew even as it burned him alive. Leaderless, the company fought on for 30 minutes, falling back again until the 3 surviving tanks ran south at 50 kilometers per hour, trying to find the battalion command post. That was no longer there. It had been located by its radio transmissions and pounded by a full brigade of UIR artillery in its unprepared position, just as the survivors from Storm Track arrived with the scout troop. In the first hour of the second Persian Gulf War, a 30-mile rent had been made in the Saudi lines, and there was a direct path to Riyadh. For that, the Army of God had lost half a brigade, a stiff price, but one which they were willing to pay. The initial picture wasn't clear. It rarely was. That was the advantage the attacker almost always had, Diggs knew. And the job of the commander was to make order from chaos and use the former to inflict the latter on his enemy. With the destruction of Stormtrack, his predator capability was temporarily gone and would have to be re-established. The 366th had deployed without J-Star's airborne radar capable of tracking the movement of ground troops. Aloft were two E-3B AWACS aircraft, each with four fighters in close attendance. 20 UIR fighters came up and started going after them. That would be exciting for the Air Force. But Diggs had his own problems. With the loss of Stormtrack and its Predator drones, he was largely blind, and his first remedial action was to order the 10th Cav's air squadron to probe west. Eddington's words had come back hard to hit him. The Saudi center of gravity might not be an economic target after all.
"Our troops are inside the kingdom," intelligence told him. "They are meeting opposition but are breaking through. The American spy post has been destroyed."
The news didn't make Darii any happier.
How did they know? How did they know?
The intelligence chief was afraid to ask how they knew what, so he dodged the issue. "It does not matter. We will be in Riyadh in 2 days, and then nothing matters."
"What do we know about the sickness in America? Why are not more people ill? How can they have troops to send?"
"This I do not know," intelligence admitted.
"What do you know?"
"It appears that the Americans have one regiment in Kuwait and another in the kingdom, with a third taking equipment from the ships, the ones the Indians failed to stop, in Dharan."
"So attack them!" Mahmud Haji almost shouted.
The arrogance of that American, calling him by name in a way that his own people might have seen and heard. And believed? "Our Air Force is attacking in the north. That is the place of decision. Any diversion from that is a waste of time," he replied reasonably.
"Missiles, then!"
"I will see."
The brigadier commanding the Saudi 4th Brigade had been told to expect nothing more than a diversionary attack in his area and to stand ready to launch a counterattack into the UIR right upon the commencement of their massed attack into Kuwait. Like many generals throughout history, he had made the mistake of believing his intelligence a little too much. He had 3 mechanized battalions, each covering a 30-mile sector, with a 5 to 10 mile gap between them. In an offensive role, it would have been a flexible deployment for harassing the enemy's flank, but the early loss of his middle battalion had split his command in 2, leaving him no easy way to command the separated parts. He next compounded the error by moving forward instead of backward. A courageous decision, it overlooked the fact that he had 100 miles of depth behind him to King Khalid Military City, space in which he could have reorganized for a weighted counterstroke instead of a fragmented impromptu one. The UIR attack was made on the model perfected by the Soviet Army in the 1970s. The initial break-in phase had been composed on a heavy brigade surging forward behind massed artillery fire. The elimination of Stormtrack had been intended from the beginning. It and Palm Bowl, they even knew the code names, were largely the eyes of their enemy's command structure. Satellites they could do nothing about, but ground-based intelligence-gathering posts were fair game. As expected, the Americans had deployed some assets, but not many, it appeared, and half of those would be day-flying aircraft. As with the Soviets, who had written the book to drive to the Bay of Biscay, the UIR would accept the cost, balancing lives against time to reach their political objective before the full weight of their potential enemies could come to bear. If the Saudis believed that Darii wanted their oil more than anything else, so be it. For in Riyadh was the royal family and the government. In doing so, the UIR risked its left flank, but Kuwait-based forces would have to negotiate the terrain of the Wadi al-Bateen, and then cross 200 miles of desert
just to get to where the army of God had already been. The key was speed, and the key to achieving speed was the rapid elimination of the Saudi fourth. The artillery still massed north of the berm tracked in on the urgent radio transmissions and commenced a relentless area fire aimed at disrupting communications and cohesion in the units that they fully expected would be used to counter the initial invasion. It was a tactic almost certain to work so long as they were willing to pay the price. One brigade each had been allocated to the three border battalions. The 4th Brigade commander also had artillery of his own, but this, he decided, was best used on the center breakthrough, to punish the units with a clear road into the heart of his nation. The support mainly went there, to harass people just passing through rather than the brigades, which were just now making contact with his remaining mechanized forces. With their destruction, he would triple the width of the gap in the Saudi lines. Diggs was in the main command post with all of this news coming in, and he realized what was happening to him after a fashion. He'd done it to the Iraqis in 1991. He'd done it to the Israelis for a couple of years as CEO of the Buffalo Cav, and he'd commanded the National Training Center for a time as well. Now he saw what it was like on the other side. Things were happening too fast for the Saudis. They were reacting rather than thinking, seeing the crisis in its magnitude but not its shape, semi-paralyzed by the speed of events which, had they been on the other side, would have seemed merely exciting and nothing more. "Have the fourth pull back about 30 clicks," he said quietly. "You have plenty of room to maneuver in." "We will stop them right there," the Saudi commander replied too automatically. "General, that is a mistake. You are risking that brigade when you don't have to. You can recover lost ground. You cannot recover lost time and lost men." But he wasn't listening, and Diggs didn't have enough stars on his collar to speak more insistently. One more day, he thought. One more goddamn day. The helicopters took their time. M Troop, 4th of the 10th, was made of 6 OH-58 Kiowa Scout choppers and 4 AH-64 Apache attack birds, all carrying more extra fuel tanks than weapons. They had warning that enemy fighters were aloft, which prohibited flying very high. Their sensors were sniffing the air for the radar emissions of SAM radars. There had to be some around, while the pilots picked their way from hilltop to hilltop, scanning forward with low-light viewing systems and longbow radars. Passing into UIR territory, they spotted the occasional scout vehicle, perhaps a company spread over 20 clicks within sight of the Kuwaiti border, they estimated, but that was all. The next 50 miles revealed much of the same, though the vehicles were heavier. Arriving on the outskirts of Al-Busayah, which the Army of God had been approaching according to satellite intelligence information, all they really found were tracks in the sand and a few groups of support vehicles, mainly fuel trucks. Destroying them wasn't their mission. Their task was to locate the enemy's main body and determine its axis of advance. That took another hour of ducking and sideslipping and darting, the helicopters leapfrogging. There were SAM vehicles around here, Russian and French-made short-range ones that helicopters knew to avoid. One Kiowa Apache team got close enough to see a column of tanks moving through a gap in the berm in brigade strength, and that was 150 miles from the point they'd left. With that information, the helicopters withdrew without taking a shot at anything. The next time, they might well come in strength, and there was no sense in warning people about the gap in their air defenses before it could be properly exploited. The 4th Brigade's easternmost battalion stood its ground, and mainly died there. By this time, UIR attack helicopters had joined in, and while the Saudis shot well, the inability to maneuver doomed them. It cost the Army of God another brigade to accomplish this mission, but at the end of it, the gap in Saudi lines was 70 miles wide. It was different in the West. This battalion, commanded now by a major with the death of his colonel, broke contact and headed southwest with half its strength, then tried to turn east, to get ahead of the advancing attack. Lacking the strength to stand, he stung and moved, in the process accounting for 20 tanks and a number of other vehicles, before running out of fuel, 30 kilometers north of KKMC. The 4th Brigade's support vehicles had gotten lost somewhere. The major radioed for help and wondered if any might arrive. It came as more of a surprise than it should have. A Defense Support System Program satellite over the Indian Ocean spotted the launch bloom. That word went to Sunnyvale, California, and from there to Dharan. It had all happened before, but not with missiles launched from Iran. The ships were scarcely half unloaded. The war was only 4 hours old when the first Scud left its truck bed launcher, heading south out of the Zagros Mountains.
"Now what?" Ryan asked. "Now you see why the cruisers are still there," Jackson replied.
Raid warning was scarcely needed. The three cruisers, plus Jones, had their radars sweeping the sky, and they all acquired the inbound ballistic track over 100 miles out. National Guardsmen, waiting their turn to fetch their tracked vehicles, watched the fireballs of surface-to-air missiles lance into the sky, leaping after things that only radars could see. The initial launch of three exploded separately in the darkness, and that was that. But the soldiers were now even more motivated to collect their tanks as the triple boom came down from 100,000 feet.
On Anzio, Captain Kemper watched the track disappear from the display. This was one other thing Aegis should be good at, though sitting still under fire wasn't exactly his idea of fun. The other event of the evening was a spirited air battle over the border. The AWACS aircraft had watched what turned out to be 24 fighters coming in directly for them in an attempt to deny the Allies air coverage. That proved a costly exercise. No attack on the E-3B aircraft was actually accomplished. Instead, the UIR Air Force continued to demonstrate its ability to lose aircraft to no purpose. But would that matter? The senior American controller on one AWACS remembered an old NATO joke. One Soviet tank general ran into another in Paris and asked, "By the way, who won the air war?" The point of it was that wars were ultimately won or lost on the ground. So it would be here. Chapter 60. Buford. It wasn't until 6 hours after the first artillery barrage that enemy intentions were clear. It took the reports of the helicopter reconnaissance to give an initial picture, but what finally turned the trick was satellite photography that was impossible to discount. The historical precedents flooded into Marion Digg's mind. When the French High Command had got wind of the German Schlieffen Plan prior to World War I, their reaction had been, "So much the better for us." That assault had barely ground to a halt outside Paris. In 1940, the same High Command had greeted initial news of another German attack with smiles, and that attack had ended at the Spanish border. The problem was that people tended to wed their ideas more faithfully than their spouses, and the tendency was universal. It was well after midnight, therefore, when the Saudis realized that the main force of their army was in the wrong place, and that their western covering force had been steamrollered by an enemy who was either too smart or too dumb to do what they'd expected him to do. To counter that, they had to fight a battle of maneuver, which they were unprepared for. The UIR, sure as hell, was driving first to KKMC. There would be a battle for that point on the map, after which the enemy would have the option of turning east towards the Persian Gulf and the oil, thus trapping Allied forces, or continuing south to Riyadh to deliver a political knockout and win the war. All in all, Diggs thought it wasn't a terribly bad plan, if they could execute it. Their problem was the same as the Saudis, though. They had a plan. They thought it was pretty good, and they too thought that their enemy would connive at his own destruction. Sooner or later, everyone did. And the key to being on the winning side was knowing what you could do and what you couldn't. This enemy didn't know the couldn't part yet. There was no sense in teaching them that too soon. In the Situation Room, Ryan was on the phone with his friend in Riyadh.
"I have the picture, Ali," the President assured him.
"This is serious.
The sun will be up soon, and you have space to trade for time. It's worked before, Your Highness."
"And what will your forces do?"
"Well, they can't exactly drive home from there, can they?"
"You are that confident?"
"You know what those bastards did to us, Your Highness."
"Why, yes, but—"
"So do our troops, my friend." And then Ryan had a request.
"This war has started badly for Allied forces," Tom Donner was saying live on NBC Nightly News. "That's what we're hearing, anyway. The combined armies of Iraq and Iran have smashed through Saudi lines west of Kuwait and are driving south. I'm here with the troopers of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, the Black Horse. This is Sergeant Brian Hutchinson of Syracuse, New York. Sergeant, what do you think of this?"
"I guess we're just going to have to see, sir. What I can tell you, B Troop is ready for anything they got. I wonder if they're ready for us, sir. You come along and watch." And that was all he had to say on the subject.
As you see, despite the bad news from the battlefield, these soldiers are ready, even eager, for contact. The senior Saudi commander hung up the phone, having just talked with his sovereign. Then he turned to Diggs.
"What do you recommend?"
"For starters, I think we should move the 5th and 2nd Brigades southwest."
"That leaves Riyadh uncovered."
"No, sir, actually it doesn't."
"We should counterattack at once."
"General, we don't have to yet," Diggs told him, staring down at the map. The 10th Shore was in an interesting position. He looked up.
"Sir, have you ever heard the story about the old bull and the young bull?"
Diggs proceeded to tell one of his favorite jokes, and one which, after a few seconds, had the senior Saudi officers nodding.
"You see, even the American television says that we are succeeding," the intelligence chief told his boss. The general, commanding the UIR Air Force, was less sanguine. In the past day, he'd lost 30 fighters, for perhaps 2 Saudi aircraft in return. His plan to bore in and kill the AWACS aircraft, which so tilted the odds in the air, had failed, and cost him a gaggle of his best-trained pilots in the process. The good news, for him, was that his enemies lacked the aircraft needed to invade his country and do serious damage. Now more ground forces were moving down from Iran to advance on Kuwait from the north, and, with luck, all he would have to do would be to cover the advance ground forces, which his people knew how to do, especially in daylight. They'd learn about that course in a few hours. A total of 15 Scud-type ballistic missiles had been launched at Dharan. Hitting the comedy ships had been a long shot at best, and all of the inbounds had either been intercepted, or, in most cases, had fallen harmlessly into the sea during a night of noise and fireworks. The last of the load, mainly trucks at this stage, were rolling off now, and Greg Kemper set his binoculars down as he watched the line of brown-painted trucks fade into the dawn haze. Where they were heading, he didn't know. He did know that about 5,000 very pissed-off National Guardsmen from North Carolina were ready to do something. Eddington was already south of KKMC with his brigade staff. His Wolfpack force would probably not get there in time to fight a battle. Instead, he had headed them to Al-Artawiya, one of those places which sometimes became important in history because roads led there. He wasn't sure if that would happen here, though he remembered that Gettysburg had been a place where Bobby Lee hoped to get some shoes for his men. While his staff did their work, the colonel lit a cigar and walked outside to see 2 companies of men arriving with their vehicles. He decided to head over that way while the MPs got them scattered into hasty defense locations. Fighters screamed overhead. American F-15Es by the look of them. Okay, he thought, the enemy'd had a pretty good 12 hours. Let him think that.
"Colonel," a Staff Sergeant Bradley Commander saluted from his hatch.
Eddington climbed up as soon as the vehicle stopped. "Good morning, sir." "How is everybody?" "We're just ready as hell, sir." "Where are they?" the sergeant asked, taking off his dust-covered goggles. Eddington pointed. "About 100 miles that way, coming this way. Tell me about how the troops feel, sergeant." "How many can we kill before they make a stop, sir?" "If it's a tank, kill it. If it's a BMP, kill it. If it's a truck, kill it. If it's south of the berm and it's holding a weapon, kill it. But the rules are serious about killing unresisting people. We don't break those rules. That's important."
"Fair enough, Colonel."
"Don't take any unnecessary chances with prisoners, either."
"No, sir," the track commander promised. "I won't."
Geometry put the Black Horse first, advancing west from their assembly area toward KKMC. Colonel Hamm had his command advancing on line, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd squadrons lined up south to north, each covering a 20-mile frontage. The 4th, Aviation Squadron, he kept in his pocket, with just a few Helo scouts probing forward while the ground support elements of their battalion moved to set up an advanced base at a point which his leading troops had not yet reached. Hamm was in his M4 command track, called, naturally enough, the Star Wars, some called it God, track, sitting athwartships, which made for motion sickness, and starting to get the take from his advanced units. The IVUS system was starting to go online now in a real tactical environment. The Inter-Vehicle Information System was a data link network the Army had been playing with for about 5 years. It had never been tested in combat, and it pleased Al Hamm that he would be the first to prove its worth. His command screens in the M4 got everything. Every single vehicle was both a source and a recipient of information. It began by telling everybody where all friendly units were, which, with GPS location equipment, was accurate to the meter, and that was supposed to prevent blue-on-blue friendly fire losses. At the touch of a key, Hamm knew the location of every fighting vehicle he had, plotted on a map which showed all relevant terrain features. In time, he would have a similarly accurate picture of enemy dispositions. And with the knowledge of everyone's location came the option to pick his spots. The Saudi 2nd and 5th Brigades were to his northwest, coming down from the Kuwaiti border area. He had about 100 miles to move cross-country before he had to worry about making contact, and the 4 hours of approach march would serve to establish control of his units and make sure that everything was working. He had few doubts of that, but it was a drill he had to perform, because mistakes on the battlefield, however small, were expensive ones. Remnants of the Saudi 4th Brigade tried to assemble north of KKMC. They amounted to perhaps 2 companies of tanks and infantry carriers, most having fought hit-and-run actions during the long desert night. Some had survived from pure luck, others through the brutally Darwinian process that was mobile warfare. The senior surviving officer was a major whose billet had been intelligence, and who had commandeered a tank from an angry NCO. His men had neglected practice on their IVUS gear, preferring gunnery and racing about instead of more structured battle drills. Well, they'd paid for that, the major knew. His first order of business was finding and calling in the scattered fuel trucks his brigade had kept to the rear, so that the surviving 29 tanks and 15 other tracks could fill up their tanks. Some ammunition trucks were also found, which allowed about half of his heavy vehicles to replenish their storage racks. With that done, he sent the support vehicles to the rear and selected a wadi, a dry riverbed, north and west of KKMC, as his next defense position. It took another 30 minutes for him to establish reliable contact with his high command and to call for support. His force was not coherent. The tanks and tracks came from 5 different battalions. Some crews knew others only casually or not at all, and he was short of officers to command what force he had. With that knowledge came the realization that his job was to command rather than to fight himself. He reluctantly returned the tank to the sergeant who owned it, and chose instead an infantry carrier with more radios and fewer distractions.
It wasn't a warlike decision, not for a person whose cultural tradition